It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Hello again.
It's been a while, Hannah.
I know. It's crazy to see you in this context again.
I see your dumbass every day.
I see your dumbass every second of every day.
Yeah, today we went to pick up our equipment and we were like, let's go on an excursion. And we were like, we never do this with each other ever. Like, this is so crazy.
It's like, we haven't gotten coffee together in like a week and a half.
We just spent like 2 full weeks together in Portugal just with each other. We were like really clamoring for some friends. Because we were like, get me the hell away from this bitch.
Yeah, I saw something on Twitter that was from this, I think it was a New York Times like advice column, and it was about, they're like, do I have to pay for my kid's platonic partner to come on a trip? And it was like, my college age daughter's best friend and roommate wants to come on vacation. And I was like, oh no, that's us coded.
I know. And what about it? Everything is us coded.
We're the center of the universe.
So this is Rehash, a podcast about the social media phenomenons that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for revisiting. This is a very, very special episode.
It's a pre-season, not really rehashing, current hashing.
Yeah, it's a current hash is what we'll call it.
Yeah.
It's a crash. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly minisodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that really helps us out.
Please help us.
This episode is a bit of a packed one because we wanted to give this topic the time and attention it deserves. So it's a special preseason two-parter episode. The first part, we'll be discussing the unleashing of ChatGPT into the public arena. And the second part, we'll be talking about the WGA strike and the implications of generative AI on Hollywood and the dangerous precedent that this may set. This is an issue that we're both really passionate about, and we wanted to release it now because it's unfolding as we speak and it's a bit time sensitive. So, ChatGPT, what is it? And why the hell is everyone talking about it all of a sudden? And why are all these pasty nerds telling me that it'll make the world a better place?
I saw the movie iRobot as a kid. And ever since then, anything about robots or AI, I've been like, shut it down. Shut it down. I can't. That movie, the robots, they turn on you.
Remember that movie Robots with Ewan McGregor as this like...
I haven't seen it.
What?
I don't like robots.
Robin Williams is in it. Well, that made me kind of like want robots. Like I was like, damn, I love these rusty old robots.
Propaganda. No.
Robot propaganda.
Yeah. Truly. I don't like it.
So this is a very unbiased episode. I just want to go back in time and just look at where ChatGPT, where it originated. It all begins with a little startup called OpenAI. It was created by this little guy named Sam Altman. And
this little guy. This tiny little pipsqueak.
Little pipsqueak, Sam Altman. And Blood Diamond, Baby Boy Genius, Extraterrestrial, Christopher Columbus, Elon Musk. It began as a nonprofit company with humble beginnings from a $1 billion investment. the sources of which are unclear. But after Elon left in 2018 to pursue his own adventures with AI at Tesla, OpenAI became a for-profit venture so that it could make more money and include employees as stakeholders. Now, this decision was criticized at the time because OpenAI's, like, original mantra was to democratize AI, with, like, Altman boasting that their mission is to ensure that AGI technology benefits all of humanity, which is not very for-profit of them. Nonetheless, OpenAI has been making waves since the beginning. A few years ago, they built a system that could beat the video game Dota 2. So this was apparently a really incredible feat because, according to this guy, Cade Metz, who writes for the New York Times, I'm going to be talking about him a lot in this article because he's written almost all of the, like, main hit pieces about this new technology. Back in 2019, he said this was a game in which each player must navigate a complex three-dimensional environment along with several other players, coordinating a careful balance between attack and defense. Then he says, in other words, it requires old-fashioned teamwork, and that's a really difficult skill for machines to master. So OpenAI achieved this through reinforcement learning, which is basically like when the machine undergoes this repeated process of trial and error until it learns like all the best strategies for winning. And then Altman told Metz in this article back in 2019 that this was just the beginning. Like, they wanted to create a learning system which could not only beat Dota 2, a learning system instead that would scrape all the data it could from the internet to effectively recreate human intelligence itself.
Which, like, honestly, human intelligence has given us enough problems in the world. Why would we want more of that shit?
Oh, yeah, and we will have some discussion about that. Because, j'agree.
If we were all a little stupider, I don't know.
I think we should all be a little bit dumber.
Or just, like, stop trying to prove that we're smart. And I can only imagine if we're recreating human intelligence, it's going to be real smug about it.
Yeah, maybe we should all practice radical acceptance about our limitations and just be like, that's okay. So this type of, like, human intelligence system that Altman was talking about, it's a system called AGI, or Artificial General Intelligence. And this is the concept, like, this is what I'm, when I'm referring to AI for the most part in this episode, that's what I'm referring to is AGI, because that is the source of contention happening right now. Because, like, AI, it's part of many facets of our current society. AGI is what is causing some issues.
So what is an example of just normal AI? Like a microwave?
Like algorithms on social media.
True. Not a microwave.
Or like maps, like Google Maps, for example.
Right,
like
uses AI.
There's it's used in many aspects of our daily life that we just don't see.
Yeah.
So artificial general intelligence was kind of this like far off concept, this idea that hadn't really come to fruition for decades, but it's been hypothesized and tested for quite a while. The most famous of these tests is the Turing test, or like the imitation game, which was created in 1950 by Alan Turing. For those of you who haven't seen the movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, it's basically the guy who saved Britain's ass in World War II, only to be killed by them later for his sexuality. Really tragic story. Look into it. So basically, the Turing test is where you get like a human evaluator to play a game with another human and a machine in which they have to decipher who the real human is. So, like, the machine is basically programmed to trick the evaluator into thinking that it's human by replicating human intelligence. Like, patterns of intelligence. The thing is, intelligence as a concept is really difficult to define, and many researchers thought that the time where a system could not just, like, mirror us, but actually think like we did was very far off in the future. Like, Turing's test, while it was, like, successful, wasn't actually proving that, like, the machine could actually like be us in a way. You know, it could just kind of mirror our patterns of intelligence. Many tests like Turing's have been conducted in the decades since, but it wasn't until the invention of deep learning in the 21st century that we would see progress really ramp up. So I'm going to use some terminology here that I'm hoping stick. If you don't understand anything, go ahead and ask, because I'm sure the listeners will also be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Oh yeah, and like literally my brain doesn't, like, I'm so stupid about this kind of thing.
Not computing. Not computing.
So, yeah, don't worry. All questions, for sure.
So, to explain, deep learning is a form of machine learning based on artificial neural networks. This is where most of the terminology is going to be coming in. So, it's based on artificial neural networks, which are these computing systems that mimic patterns in the human brain. and deep learning rose to prominence in 2012 when this renowned computer scientist Geoffrey Hinton and two of his PhD students from the University of Toronto submitted a neural network called AlexNet to this annual online contest called the ImageNet Challenge. Okay. And ImageNet is this online database of like millions of images, and the challenge that they pose to people is essentially to create a computer that can recognize and label as many of the images on the database as possible. And so 2 years before, in 2010, the record was an accuracy rate of 72%. Like, that was what that record-breaking computer had done. But when AlexNet came, it surpassed that record by a long shot with 85% accuracy by using this new deep learning technique. And this triggered a series of advancements that led to the computer basically surpassing humans at the challenge for the first time ever. Mm. And their deep learning system is now used like everywhere, from like tagging on Facebook to like, do you ever wonder why your phone recognizes people's faces? Because I do, and it freaks me out.
Yeah, I'm really like, I didn't tell you you could do that. Why are you doing that?
I did not tell you that. It's also used with like self-driving cars. So this, to some people in the field, signaled that AGI was in a way almost here. It had been a far-off dream, but now it was getting a bit closer. So, what does this all have to do with OpenAI? Remember how I said that they wanted to create a learning system that would basically completely replicate human intelligence?
Yeah.
Well, okay, that was in 2019, and...
similar time!
It didn't take them very fucking long. It did not take them very long, because in 2020, a year later, they came out with GPT-3. Which is a system that scrapes data from the internet, and when you give it a prompt, it answers you by regurgitating this data through natural language patterns. So it can recommend movies to you, it can generate customized meal plans, it can write a college admissions essay, it can teach you how to code, it can plan your next vacation, it can write a Shakespeare poem about Drake and Pusha T's beef, I don't know. OpenAI then also came out with DALL-E, which is basically the same prompt-based technology, except that instead of responding in the written word, it creates like completely new digital images. So you can like describe something to it and it'll create an image out of that. GPT-3 and DALL-E are generative AI, in that they can create or like generate a wide variety of data, and the website says, such as like images, videos, audio, text, and 3D models. This year, they released an updated, even like more advanced version of the system called GPT-4, which is why it's kind of coming into the conversation again. Mm-hmm. And this one can ace the bar exam, it can calculate your tax liability, and it can describe images in like vivid detail. The reason that this came to everyone's attention is because the technology was released to the public in the form of a chatbot called ChatGPT. With a free version of it, which uses GPT-3, and a premium version that uses GPT-4. It is extremely convenient. Like, everyone is using it right now. Do you know anyone who's using it at the moment?
No, but I also haven't started those conversations with people, because if I'm talking to someone that I know and respect, and then I learn that they're using that, like, I can't, like, react in a normal way to that. I literally can't. I'm really I don't know. I don't think it's irrational. It might seem irrational, but I would just be like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I know some people who've been using it. One of my friends used it to write her cover letters, which I get. Cover letters are a bitch to write, and they're annoying and kind of unnecessary. So she was using it for that. I know a few other people who've used it for various reasons. The technology isn't just being used by private individuals, though. It's also being put to commercial use by, like, some pretty big companies. So, for example, like, Morgan Stanley has been using it to help financial advisors gather data from large documents. And there's been this huge push to also incorporate it as a learning tool for kids. So, like, Khan Academy, for example, is building an automated tutor with it right now. These guys are both using GPT-4. And I read this one paper where this guy was like, his name is Mehmet Ferhat, and he argues that ChatGPT, quote, is becoming more and more well-liked as a means of increasing access to and affordability of education. This guy isn't the only one who thinks that ChatGPT and other AI technologies are going to do, like, basically net good for the world. There's this, like, venture capitalist, Reid Hoffman. I think he's one of the founders of PayPal. Mm-hmm. But he's got his fingers in a whole bunch of tech pies. He went on this media tour recently telling everyone that AI is going to improve humanity, and he also argued that it would transform the education system, and then he also argued that it would transform healthcare, And his solution is that AI is going to give everyone their own medical assistant. OpenAI has also been saying this kind of stuff. Like, this isn't just coming from these guys outside of, like, it's coming from OpenAI too.
Obviously, they're saying that. That's like, they want people to use it.
But also because OpenAI's whole thing is that they're making, like, friendly AI. Like, that is what allowed them to forge their own little path here. Like, again, they say that their technology, their AGI technology is going to benefit all humanity. And, like, again, they put a lot of emphasis on the idea of, like, democratizing the technology. So basically, these guys are all saying that AI is essentially, like, it has the singular use as a tool for human progress, basically. Mm-hmm. There's this diary of a CEO interview with this guy, Mo Gaudat, who used to be the chief business officer for Google X. And basically, in the interview, he talks about the dangers of AGI. Like, he's coming on to kind of shed light on what he was seeing. But he says something in the interview which just kind of caught my attention. It just made me think a lot about, like, how the people who are in charge of this technology think. So I'm going to play it for you.
There is a scenario, possibly a likely scenario, where we live in a utopia, where we really never have to worry again, where we stop messing up our planet, because intelligence is not a bad commodity. More intelligence is good. The problems in our planet today are not because of our intelligence. They are because of our limited intelligence.
I don't know, it's like putting a lot of hope and trust in the people who are going to have control over this technology and who are developing it to actually look out for our best interests. We talk about, like, oh, it could be a utopia where we don't have to, like, do as many things and we're free to do this stuff. But it's coming from this, like, really Western idea of, like, things being democratized and easier. But okay, what about people who don't have access to, like, technology in that way, or, like, who this technology isn't being geared towards, like, in other parts of the world?
Yeah, in what way would this technology actually be in everyone's hands? And if it's in everyone's hands, what does that mean either? Like, I've just been really thinking about this idea of progress as a concept. I think progress is something we use as this, like, universal good. It's like a concept that we never question, but we never really talk about what that means, right?
Yeah.
With the risk of sounding like a Luddite, which I'm going to explain what this is. It has two usages. Basically, we use it today as a derogatory term for someone who, like, opposes technological advancement. But do you want to give the people just, like, a brief sentence on what the historical Luddite was?
Well, the Luddites were garment factory workers in England. And then with automation and, like, advances in technology, they were finding themselves, like, people who had done apprenticeships and were, like, trained professionals and, like, experienced professionals being replaced by these machines. So they destroyed a bunch of machines to make a statement.
But today we use it derogatorily. So I'm going to say, like, with the risk of sounding like a Luddite derogatory, I don't think that the majority of our problems are because we lack raw intelligence, to be completely frank. Like, I think it's because we're fucking greedy and we lack basic compassion. Like, I think it's very different for everyone, but to me, progress means becoming a more loving society, personally.
Yeah.
But to these guys, like, all progress means is convenience, like, greater human convenience. But I've just been feeling more and more that human beings, we kind of need struggle, and, like, we need lack. Like, we need some lack. We need to be working towards something. And I don't mean in the sense of being exploited, but I mean that, like, we're on this planet and we are trying to survive. And I know that technology is supposed to make our survival on this planet easier, but we've kind of surpassed that in some ways. Like, we're surpassing it. Just why does everything need to be easy? Like, is that what the project of humanity is about? Obviously, I don't have the answers, but to me, it's not about making things ridiculously easy and just having to assuage all of our, like, responsibilities.
It's also, like, you know, technological advancements make things easy for some people, but because of the world we live in, because of who is in control of the world that we live in, there are always going to be ways to use it to, like, oppress other people. You're Wrong About did a great episode about the Stepford Wives, where they talked about how advancements in technologies in, like, the first half of the 20th century, like, you know, the oven and, like, whatever, like, the iron and all of that stuff was supposed to make lives easier for women or for housewives, but it actually just meant that they
created more expectations for them and like more things for them to do. And I think that like there are always going to be people who get the short end of the stick with this. Like, yeah, it could be a utopia for like rich white men who are these billionaires, but like life is already a utopia for them.
Exactly.
Right? So I don't know. It's like, and then they're selling these people, you know, there's a bit of a cult of personality around these figures, and they're selling it to these people that like your life can be as convenient and easy as mine. And it's like, that's never going to happen. There's always going to be somebody who benefits from it. And then there's always going to be a ton of people who are going to be getting the short end of the stick, or who we're going to find a way to make life harder or just like the same for, you know.
Well, exactly. And like, to me, the idea of democratized tech or democratized AGI is like such corporate jargon, because ultimately the idea of a product that's whatever created for everyone isn't inherently democratic to me. What's democratic is like allowing me and everyone else on this fucking continent, in this fucking world, who could be affected by this down the line, to decide whether or not we want this. Like, I haven't been able to say that I actually don't really want ChatGPT. No. Fucking want it, and I never got a chance to say it, because these guys, they don't care whether or not people don't want it. That would be democratic.
Honestly, if I could have opted out of the iPhone, knowing what I know now, I would have.
Well, yeah, it's like,
I sound like a Luddite.
Like these, and also not to be too deterministic about it, but it's like, you know, it does feel like they're releasing this technology more and more, and then they're making it so much harder to exist without it. Like, it's very hard to exist without an iPhone these days. And it's like, I know that I sound like a caveman, but it's like, you're making people who don't use it obsolete. And that, to me, is scary. They're like, keep up or you won't be able to live in this society. And I mean Western society. Like, I mean North American. I'll just speak on our behalf.
It's a way to placate us a little bit. You know, you're keeping us distracted with this shit. And like, we don't know what else is going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel that way too. Like, I do
think. The man behind the curtain, you know?
Yeah, I think that everything is, like, this whole concept of making things easier means that they're like, look over here and don't actually look at the real problems. Which brings me to kind of my next question. What do you think of the idea of using ChatGPT or like GPT-3, GPT-4 as like a medical assistant or a tutor to solve problems in education and healthcare?
Yeah, I've heard people make arguments for AI for healthcare, but like, I don't know enough about it to be like, these are the pros and these are the cons. I don't know if doctors who understand this stuff can make a case for like why like using it can make their jobs easier and make it so they're able to see more people more efficiently, because like, I don't know, I've had a lot of like really awful experiences with the doctor in the past year. If it can make it easier and there are arguments for it, sure.
I mean, help the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
But it has made things easier.
And I'm sure like when benefit a lot of people with the education stuff, it's just like, so we're gonna standardize education so much, because when I think about the idea of using like something like that or like an algorithm or AI for teaching kids, that's just making education so standard. If you talk to any person, they've probably had like a really special experience with a specific class or a specific teacher, or had like a relationship or something that opened their eyes to something or changed them. And so the idea of that becoming like something more standardized, I don't know.
Yes, this kind of technology is great to be used as like an assistant or a tool to like further your ability to do something within these fields. But to me, like, it's saying that it's going to solve the education problem, solve the healthcare problem, it's like, of course, America is fucking finding a private sector solution to what's a very easy public sector fix. Like, yeah, your healthcare is fucking unaffordable because it's privatized. Your education system is garbage because of redlining and because of propaganda. Like, your education system is terrible because of, like, ridiculous poverty in the country. Mm-hmm. Other countries do have fine education systems. But, like, you guys need a robot to teach your kids because you, like, refuse to pay teachers, you refuse to lower tuition fees, or end redlining. And it's like, I understand using the AI to, like, help, but to say that it's going to solve the problem is like, but that's not the problem. Like, there is a root cause of the problem. Is AI going to make healthcare affordable? Does it actually, like, expand America's education system? Is this going to find a solution to ending war? Like, they keep being like, oh, we're going to get this AI to drag men out of the war zone. And it's like,
how?
We're spending billions of dollars making technology to, like, put band-aids on solutions that if you just put a little time and effort within the government, within the fucking public sector to fix, you wouldn't need this. But it's just like, you're, again, with the distraction, it's like, let's go and look in this direction instead of actually looking at the cause, you know?
Also, just with the education thing, I've just meant like everyone learning the same thing at all times.
Making education accessible is accessible, we both believe in that.
Is, yeah. Yes, is good. I think I'm more just thinking like, especially somewhere like the state, depending on who's in charge, if there's one kind of thing being taught across people and there are some bad characters in charge, I don't know.
So the paradigm shift that ChatGPT triggered is basically in the fact that now a machine has more or less mastered language. For a lot of scholars, something that lies at the core of like what it means to be human is to observe the world around us and endow it with meaning. First in like our minds and then outward with language. And in this paper he wrote for this journal called Daedalus about ChatGPT, this renowned scholar, Tobias Reed, said that our modern understanding of what it means to be human is, quote, grounded in the idea that we humans are the only talking thing in a world of mute things. Which, okay, to me is like a very positivist way to approach that, like very Enlightenment thinking, very Western to be like, humans are the only species that actually talks. Like, I just think that that's very arrogant.
Yeah, Mooney says stuff to us all the time.
She's saying something to me right now.
My yes cat. for the non longtime fans.
for the newbies. But basically Reed's worry with ChatGPT is that he says if language were no longer exclusive to humans, then comprehension of reality that silently structures the modern understanding and experiencing of the world would no longer hold. And this is made an even bigger problem when generative AI claims not only to master the human word, but also to mimic human creativity. And that is what its website purports to be able to do. So fears about unleashing this technology on the world were already brimming, you know, under the surface. But they went completely off the rails when Jeff Hinton, who is the AlexNet creator and also considered the godfather of AI himself, left his job with Google in May to speak out against the technology that he basically helped to pioneer. One of the two students who helped him make AlexNet is actually now one of the lead scientists at OpenAI. So it's interesting because there's a bit of a schism here. There's actually quite a bit of pushback from the industry in general right now. Like a couple months ago, 1,000 tech leaders and researchers signed this open letter asking for a 6-month moratorium on the development of AGI after GPT-4 was released. And even Elon spoke out about it.
With respect to AI, I just think we should have some sort of regulatory oversight. So, you know, for anything that is a danger to the public, if it's sort of aircraft, cars, food and drug and whatnot, we've got some regulatory oversight, like a referee, essentially, and making sure that companies don't cut corners is a potential risk to the public. Then there should be some regulatory body that oversees what companies are doing so that they don't cut corners and potentially do something very dangerous.
But Hinton speaking out was kind of the biggest deal considering he, like, you know, basically invented this. Now, there are two types of risks that AGI poses. One is already starting to happen, which we will get to in a bit. And the other is potentially a bit further in the future, which is the one I think is really living in the pit of your stomach.
Yeah, I really was hoping you were going to be like, Hannah, you silly little goose.
Well, no. So, we'll talk about it. Hinton and like other guys in his field are mainly concerned with the second future risk. Have you heard of a little thing called the singularity?
No. I really like this is going to send me into an existential spiral.
No, it's going to be okay as long as we are talking about it, right?
Yeah.
Basically, and this has been an idea in science fiction novels since like forever. 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Frankenstein.
I'm just naming movies.
Right?
Frankenstein, yes, exactly. Blade Runner, like, do androids dream of electric sheep?
iRobot.
iRobot. So the concern basically is that the machine is operating at such a speed that it'll start to surpass the intelligence of human beings. The singularity is when the machine knows things that we can never know as a species. They kind of liken it to gazing into a black hole, right? Like if you're standing on the edge of a black hole and you're looking in, you have no idea what's in it. And you can really never know as far as we're concerned right now, right? So it's like standing on the precipice of something and you can't go any further forward. But this machine can. It kind of reminds me of the Roy Batty monologue in Blade Runner when he's like, I've seen the rings of Saturn. It's like this android is dying and he's basically talking about all the stuff he's seen that human beings can never see. The reason this fear is being expressed, because it sounds very science fiction-y and kind of insane, is because ChatGPT has recently triggered a sort of arms race. So Microsoft spent $10 million to incorporate it into their Bing search engine, which then led Google to up the ante on its own AI technology in order to keep up, which resulted in a similar chatbot called Google Bard. And basically the worry that Hinton and all these people are having is that because of this sort of like competition, you know, capitalist mindset, these tech giants are escalating the technology so quickly that the singularity, which Hinton initially thought to be like 40 or 50 years away, may happen a bit sooner. So 3 days after the Hinton article was published, Biden called Altman and the CEOs of Google and Microsoft to discuss AGI at the White House. And Biden was basically like, these machines are potentially really dangerous. But then they were like, you guys fix it. I don't really know. Like Kamala Harris's statement after the meeting was literally like, the private sector has an ethical, moral, and legal responsibility to ensure the safety and security of their products, and every company must comply with existing laws to protect the American people. Like, you are the fucking government. Just govern. Like, why is it up to the completely unregulated private sector to regulate themselves? Why would they do that when there are profits involved? Like, when ever has the private sector ever acted in service of the public? Like, you live in an oligarchy.
Yeah, like, okay? Literally grow a backbone, for fuck's sake.
Put in some regulations now.
I'm sorry. You just have to know that this is the kind of shit that, like, kept me up at night growing up. This is why I don't like science fiction. I don't watch Star Wars. I don't engage with this shit. I don't like it. And I feel crazy talking about it, but now, it's coming real.
I mean, my gut instinct, like, I honestly never was scared of that or never really cared very much, but my gut thing was always just kind of like, why are you guys diddling yourselves with this chat bot technology when the world is currently burning? And you are, like, diddling around with little chatbots and little apps that'll, like, you know, whatever, make a picture. Like, why?
Because what they want to do is they want to, like, tap us all into a Matrix type thing, because the planet will be inhabitable and we will be, like, kept alive in, like, another, like, thing.
Okay. I think it's important to be careful not to jump to fear, because I don't think fear is going to help us here either.
I know, I'm
but also
sorry.
It's fair if it's your particular childhood fear.
This in 2012 and that didn't happen, so, you know. Okay, so if generative AI gets its intelligence by scraping data on the internet, data that, like, humans have put in, that's our data, how is it that the singularity could happen? Like, how can it know something that we don't know if everything it knows comes from us?
So the general fear that Hinton was talking about is that it's not like ChatGPT itself, and we'll get to this. Some people are debating whether or not it actually is artificial general intelligence, because, like, ChatGPT itself isn't that intelligent, which we'll talk about. The fear is that this kind of technology, this, like, deep learning technology, is going to be used in other ways for worse purposes. And also, it's the idea that these systems are being taught, or, like, people are scared that they're being taught to not only, like, generate their own computer code, but, like, eventually run that code themselves. Okay. Like, that's what people are scared they're being trained to do, which is when they can run their own code, what is that? That means that they can kind of control themselves.
Right. Okay.
And Hinton says this a lot. Like, if it's put into the wrong hands, what are people going to do with that technology? What are they going to use? And, like, the article uses the term autonomous weapons. So that is the general fear. But right now with ChatGPT, everyone is freaking out about this. Everyone's kind of freaking out about the idea of machines running their own code, being autonomous. But yes, we should have our guards up about it, but, like, I don't think we should be too alarmist yet and, like, jump to conclusions. Hinton is also pretty grounded in his fears. He mentions a lot of things that are coming a lot sooner. ChatGPT is really smart, but it's also, like, kind of stupid. So, like, you know, ChatGPT scrapes the web for information, and information is what makes up its knowledge, right? But information isn't everything that intelligence is comprised of. Like, in a lot of cases, the system has failed to do basic arithmetic. It has trouble answering questions about events that will take place in the future. Like, it can't conceive of those, depending on how you ask it. And apparently it's pretty bad at writing, which we will get to in your segment of this episode. Specifically, it's bad at writing jokes because it doesn't understand the nuance of what makes human beings laugh, right? Like, there's a subtlety, there's intonation, like, there's a lot of things that go into writing a joke that isn't just knock knock who's there, you know. Ted Chiang, who's this like super prolific sci-fi writer and like computer scientist type guy, described ChatGPT as a blurry JPEG of all the text on the internet, in the sense that it's like more of an approximation of data rather than an exact replica of it, and definitely not a better version of it yet. He's actually really unconcerned with a singularity for the moment, which of course, like, it is his word versus the guy who like invented deep learning. So it's kind of like, it's hard to know who to trust. I do think we should not be too alarmist. It's also like, this guy still worked for Google, made his good old millions off of them, and then left and then decided to speak out. So it's like, I don't know. But essentially, Chiang says that right now we have much, much bigger fish to fry. Whether or not ChatGPT is a blurry JPEG of the internet is kind of not even in the question, because the biggest threat we're facing right now is the fact that major corporations all over the world look at ChatGPT and all they see is green. This is why, like, the singularity I'm not thinking about so much at the moment, because, like, ChatGPT is very new. Like we were saying, it can just kind of, like, mirror and approximate things, but it's not, like, better than us. And so Hinton, on top of his existential fears, like, he says that ChatGPT could basically do two big things in the immediate sense. One is that it can be used to spread disinformation. There's been, like, a bunch of studies where researchers will prompt the bot with false narratives, and it'll respond by creating false or misleading claims based on that prompt. So an example that they used was where they prompted it to write a paragraph in the voice of this anti-vaccine advocate, Joseph Mercola, about Pfizer adding tromethamine to vaccines administered to children. And the bot, like, literally did that, like, very effectively in his voice, very persuasively. So people are really scared that it's going to basically manufacture major disinformation campaigns or, like, conspiracy theories or scams on the internet, as if there wasn't already so much fake shit out there already. And then the other very tangible thing is that ChatGPT is going to topple a lot of jobs. People whose jobs are to, like, basically administer rote or, like, data-centric tasks can and already are being replaced in some industries en masse, like, immediately. They're calling that, like, coders and programmers, market research analysts, financial analysts and advisors, and these are, like, quote-unquote, like, skilled jobs, like, oh, you know.
There was a second where we all thought that, like, our generation was fucked because we didn't learn to code and the kids right below us did. And now it's like, jokes on those losers.
Jokes on those guys. I did do Code Academy for like a couple months.
That's cute.
Do I remember anything? No. Graphic designers are also in this cohort. Accountants, customer service representatives, which, like, that's kind of been a thing for a bit, are at immediate risk. Why? Because companies want to cut on labor costs. So Chiang says that the singularity isn't his main concern. What he says instead is, quote, I do think that AI is dangerous in as much as it increases the power of capitalism. Mm-hmm. Like, insofar as hyper-capitalists are going to basically completely erase middle-earning jobs in pursuit of profit. And he says, and this is like a very, this is a very common sentiment among us anti-capitalists, that rather than AI being the machine that'll prevent us from turning it off, it's capitalism, quote, that will do whatever it takes to prevent us from turning it off. And the most successful weapon in its arsenal has been its campaign to prevent us from considering any alternatives. He talks about the Luddites, and we use this derogatorily, but he says that the original Luddites weren't just like random people who were scared of technology. They were actually people, like you had been explaining, they were garment workers, textile workers, who were protesting lowering wages as factory owners' pockets got fatter. The original Luddites, they weren't destroying machines for funsies. They weren't like, get rid of technology because I'm scared. They destroyed them in the name of economic justice.
Mm-hmm.
going back to our conversation about progress, like, you have to ask what progress means if all these advancements are doing is putting money in the pockets of the 1% and leaving the rest of us, like, out of work and fucking poor, mm-hmm. right? What is democratic about that?
It's funny because what it does is it just devalues, like, every single type of skill or particular ability or talent that a specific person might have or, like, train towards, and, like, just, yeah, renders them valueless economically, but then also through that, just socially, culturally, in a way where it becomes only useful to understand the kinds of things that allow this technology to operate. Which is kind of terrifying to me because I hate science nerds. Okay, I don't hate all of you. But you know what I mean?
You pasty little shitters.
I don't hate science nerds. But I don't think that that's the only way to be intelligent. In fact, I don't think it is a more valuable form of intelligence than other forms of intelligence. I am not intelligent in that way, I'll tell you that. But I think, how is it a democracy if some people's contributions to society are giving all the value and everything else is just, like, washed over because technically you could get a machine to do it in some way? That's not a democracy. We're not valued, then we just become, like, useless.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying about different forms of intelligence, I just think so much of this idea, like, you know, this complete entanglement of technology and progress together, like, you at this point in time, like, you actually can't separate the two from each other. They're completely conflated. I think it just goes back to the Enlightenment. I think the Enlightenment actually did, like, a lot of bad in many ways, like, this insistence on living in a society founded upon logic and reason and upholding that as, like, the most basic form of intelligence. Like, when this guy is saying we need more intelligence, because to him and to all the guys freaking out about generative AI is that they're scared that, like, it's going to be better than us in general. And it's like, but it just is a compilation of, like, data. Yeah. And human beings aren't just compilations of data. The greatest human beings aren't just compilations of data. Like, great human beings, people we consider great, have had many facets to them. And it's like, you know, we talked a lot in school about this idea of positivism and the idea of, like, logic and reason, and how we should try to strive towards a society that also upholds, like, you know, those values are considered inherently masculine, and then there, you know, there are values that are considered inherently feminine, like emotionality, and it's like, maybe we should be propping that up a little bit too, you know what I mean? Propping up emotional intelligence, propping up compassion, propping up love, the capacity to love other people.
Empathy. Honestly, we need more, like, astrology girlies, like, making policy decisions is what I've decided.
Yeah. I can barely hang out with them at a party, but I
don't
for sure.
You
for
don't
sure,
need to talk to them. They should just be...
Okay, sorry. We actually have quite a few friends who are into astrology.
This idea of, like, wanting to have answers to every question and, like, know all the knowledge of the universe...
No stone left unturned.
I think is going to destroy us. Like, I think that endless pursuit of that and of answering the things that are meant to be left unknown, I think yes. that's the beautiful thing about human existence, and something that, like, I've had to come to terms with is our mortality, and is the fact that there are some answers that we will never get. We Embrace. Won't understand why we're here. We won't understand why certain things happen, certain good things, certain bad things, that they just sometimes they just do, and we have experiences we can't explain.
Aspects of nature that we don't understand. Like, embrace yeah. the black hole.
Things
embrace
talk-
the black hole.
Well, exactly. Instead of calling it a black hole, it's just this beautiful question, and we get to just make sense of things for ourselves. So it brings ourselves comfort. I mean, art, religion, like, relationships, these all come out of, like, trying to fill the void that this black hole has left. And I think that those are some of the most important aspects of our life and our existence as human beings. That's what matters. And so it's...
I just think it's like, and we need balance, right? And, like, when does this stop, right? If we're going to just put throw technology into the progress pool and be like, I'm never taking it out, and just we think of ourselves on this upward trajectory, and the only way to get upwards is through, like, technological advancement. It's like, a lot of the issues in our society could be fixed if we didn't have greed in the equation, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, America wouldn't have a privatized healthcare system if it wasn't so fucking greedy, you know? People at the top weren't so greedy. And we actually would have, like, things would get done. And I don't think you need the craziest fancy technology to actually solve a lot of our issues. Maybe it'll help us down the line, but it's like, I don't know. I also don't need to live forever. Like, maybe I would like to live a bit easier. But honestly, a lot of us have it pretty good right now.
Well, yeah.
With the technology that we have.
Existential fears and, like, fear of death from these men that have too much money and think that that money can solve all their problems because it can solve so many of the other problems in their lives. Like, them trying to pacify that anxiety and that fear is what is going to destroy us, because they're never going to get it. They're never going to solve the main problem of life, which is that it is fleeting.
Well, it's hubris. It's hubris. Like, this concept that, like, human beings can master nature and, like, dominate it and conquer it is what's led us to where we are now with our fucking climate crisis. Like, yeah. That is what has gotten us here, that mentality. And it actually has gotten us into a worse place that we've ever been. I just wish that the public sector would step in and just regulate. Like, it's okay. Go make your fucking chatbot, but regulate it. Regulate it. And I think allowing these, like, major corporations, putting it into their hands, isn't going to do anyone any good. And no, I actually don't think everyone on this earth needs ChatGPT. I think we need to stop throwing around the word democratic so much, because there's nothing democratic about that. It's the same concept of being like, give everyone a gun.
But also, like, I'm sorry, I didn't fucking elect Elon Musk to do shit. I didn't elect you. You just had lots of money and you did stuff with that money that was not necessary, a lot of it.
Yeah, that guy's a donk. I think I stand in the middle of Chang and Hinton. Like, I do harbor, you know, fears about the singularity, but right now, like, I am very scared about job obsolescence. Like, that is currently what my main concern is. Sure, Chang says that he doesn't think AGI is going to, like, take over the world because it's a blurry JPEG. And, like, you know, he actually says that large language models trying to supplant creative industries like writing is like using a photocopier to create art. But my question when I was reading that was, like, what happens when the people who employ artists don't fucking care whether the art is a photocopy? Like, maybe ChatGPT can actually supplant art, but it can supplant the artist materially. And what we'll be covering in the second part of this preseason special is the writer's strike in Hollywood and what it means for the future of creative industries everywhere.
So we'll join you in a second. Also, sorry, I've been such a negative kind of doomsday, like...
It's hard not to be, also. That's just your genuine feeling about it.
It's my genuine feeling, and it's like how you can't talk about the Kardashians in a nuanced way. This is my Kardashians.
Well, it's also hard not to get scared when all these people who are the experts, like, we don't understand how this technology works.
And by design,
and these guys who made it are telling us that they're scared. It's like, that's not very comforting information.
No, it's not. And it's like, my brain was not built for this. Like, my brain was built for, like, talking about reality TV.
Cannot compute.
Cannot compute. Goodbye.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.